and it's with a great deal of pleasure. And I asked him, where are you from? And he says, Orange County. And so that's exactly the way I'm going to introduce him. Keith D. from Orange County. Keith?
Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. And by God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, rooms full of people like you and a little bit of effort on my own, hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. It's a privilege for me to be here this morning fully clothed and in my right mind, and I want to thank the committee for inviting me to participate in the program. It's always a privilege for me to participate in my own recovery and to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a special privilege to be able to stand here and look you in the eye and be transparent, because when I can stand here and let you see me, I can see you. My wife was unable to come this weekend. She had to stay home and study the steps. She's an Al-Anon, a real Al-Anon. She works the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But she's occasionally, I wouldn't call it a slip, but, you know, they know what to say at the right time. And the last thing she said to me before she told me she loved me was, remember, your spirituality is directly proportional to your pocketbook. And remember that if you lose a bunch of money, you're going to be depressed Sunday morning. I want to report. I didn't lose. I got $1,100 of their money. So I'm pretty serene. The spiritual part of that is I haven't bet nothing this morning. But I think win, lose, or draw, we're a room full of winners. And I'm going to probably run home and give her half of that money. If you believe that. But I'm grateful to be here. I'm a real alcoholic. You heard Franklin talk about it last night. I'm a real alcoholic, in case you wondered what one looked like. It seems like it's necessary for me to say that, probably for me. I'm not an authority on alcoholism. Alcoholics Anonymous is my advocation, not my vocation. And everything I know here, I got here. I'm a thief. I stole everything that I knew. I didn't come here with an original idea of any kind. I'm a product of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful for that. But in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes a real alcoholic. It says a real alcoholic is someone who was insanely drunk most of the time. It also goes on to say that a real alcoholic will use a little dope to enhance their drinking and their thinking and to calm their nerves. And it says by no means is this a general case, but it's one they use and it fit me. Now, I heard it when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and maybe you can identify with it because it pretty well describes what I was like. I used to drink a little beer and think maybe I ought to do something. You know, I'd smoke a little of that weed and kind of fantasize how I was going to do it. And then I'd shoot a little speed so I had the strength to do whatever it was I was going to do. And then I'd snort a little of that coke so I'd be cool when I did it. And then I'd drink a little whiskey and forget what the hell it was I was going to do. I don't identify with anybody that specializes. That's fine. I'm a pig myself. I did it all, and I'm grateful for that because it hadn't been necessary for me to wonder if there's anything out there I ought to do. As far as I know, the only thing I didn't do while I was out there was die drunk. So, I drank alcohol until I achieved pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, bought myself a bag of dope and Harley Davidson, and became a legend in my own mind. And, there's some other legends in here. I can feel them. But I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic today. I was born in Texas, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're an alcoholic either, but it gives you some character defects. You pour a little Jack Daniels on them. I've always had the ability to recognize your character defects and a real need to tell you about them. Therefore, drinking was a contact sport for me. I run into a lot of things and a lot of people, and I'm a fourth-generation alcoholic. My father's an alcoholic, his father was an alcoholic, and I didn't really want to look a whole lot farther than that. The significant thing that I share with you today is that my father is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if he don't drink between now and the 27th of this month, he'll have 10 years of sobriety. The 27th of August is my belly button birthday. I'll be 47 years old, and he'll be 10 years sober. He could never remember my belly button birthday, but he don't forget it now. And the important thing about that is I got 14 months of seniority on him, and I don't ever let him forget that either. The rigorous honesty of Alcoholics Anonymous is the simple fact that he's just my old man. He's just my old man. He's a lawyer, and I always needed a lawyer. I told him one time, every time we talk, it seems to me like you're interrogating me, and he said I was, you know. He was one of these guys that kept track of every penny that he ever gave me or used to get me out of trouble. And after we both were sober a period of time, I got to thinking about it. Maybe I ought to talk to him about my financial amends. I had no idea how much it was. I knew he had a ledger sheet with everything on it. And I didn't know how to handle that, so I asked God, and God gave me the words to say. It came to me real clear. And I called my dad up, and I said, I need to meet you. I want to talk to you about making financial amends. And we got together. I said, I need to make financial amends to you. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to tell you something. I'm not going to pay one damn dime back. He said, you know, my amends to you is after I was sober 6 months, I tore that ledger up. And that's the simplicity of this program, and that's the love and the relationship that a father and son's supposed to have. And he's just my old man. Just my old man. Been able to put his arms around me and hold me like a father should hold a son. And our house is in order today. Our house is in order. He still lives back in the Texas, Oklahoma panhandle, and we got a good relationship. I got certain character defects that have caused me an awful lot of pain in my life. And probably the one that's caused me the most pain is the fact that you can line 10 women up against that wall over there and I'll get the sickest one every time. I love sick women. Is something about a sick, crazy woman that just excites me. You know? Mary's got it. I like Mary. Let me see. I did a lot of speed. That's like going 150 miles an hour with your feet nailed to the floor. My biggest fear was that my body was going to die and my head was going to keep on living. And you need a sick woman when you're like that because you don't have time to pack. And you want to go places and do things immediately. And I married one once that wasn't sick. Her daddy was one of the 10 richest men in the state of Texas. After 9 months in that relationship, they called me in, and he told me, he said, you know, I'm a very wealthy man. And I said, yes. And he said, I didn't get that way by making bad investments. And he said, you're a bad investment. And he talked to me about what it'd take for me to get out of their life, and I settled up with him when he got drunk. Later, I recognized I sold out too cheap, but I made a solemn vow from that point on that if anybody ever asked me what it'd take for me to get the hell out of their life, I'd change the price, but unfortunately, nobody's ever asked me that. And I swore that I'd never, ever, ever fall in love again. And I didn't for a little while. It took me about 2 days to get from Galveston, Texas, up to Amarillo, Texas, and I went to a little Saturday night dance. Now, things weren't going too good for me. I was 19 years old. I did 18 months in a little correctional place down there in Texas. The state of Texas had taken away my driver's license forever. I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything going for me. And when them little Saturday night dances in the Texas panhandle, I don't know about you, but they have them down in them places down on Wolf Creek, in them Quonset huts and their honky-tonks. And the sheriff don't even come down there. Unless somebody's shooting the place up, and then they wait till they're loading their clips again. And standing down there Saturday night at midnight, whenever the band took an intermission, I didn't have nothing going for me, and I was standing against that wall not doing nothing. I looked around, and I took a Coke bottle and rolled it up to the end of the dance floor, and I said, let me and the sucker in the house bring that back. It looked like a stampede coming my direction. I hit the first guy leading that charge, and I figured he's stupid enough to lead that charge while I'd get him first. I'm not one of those guys that come to Alcoholics Anonymous who had lost a lot of fights. I didn't stick around until they were over. That's the trick. At that time, I was hiding in the woman's restroom. And I hit this old boy and took off running. As I went in the woman's restroom, there's a blonde-headed lady standing there, and I said, tell me when the fight's over, okay? And I run in there and hid in one of the stalls, and I didn't realize it, but till later I found out she finished the fight. And then she come in and said, you can come out now, cowboy. And I thought it was only befitting she'd guarded the door or whatever. I'd ask her to dance, and I'm a quick study. Don't take me long to get the information I need. I found out in one quick dance she had a car, she had a job, she had a place to stay, she had money in the bank, and I fell in love. Met all her requirements. And I asked her to take me home with her. And unbeknownst to me, she was pre-Al-Anon, and she was looking for something to fix. She just got out of an unwed mother's home down in South Texas, so she had it all together. She knew the mistakes that she'd made, and she wasn't going to make them again. And we started going together. We didn't fall in love with each other. We fell in sick with each other. And what that means is that the rocks in my head fit the holes in hers. And we immediately became crime partners. And we started running around. And she could drive. And she could do all those things. And she could take care of me. And that's what she needed, I suppose. And we didn't rush into anything because we both had some bad experiences, so we just kind of hung around with each other for a period of time. And after a period of time, she told me that she was pregnant and that I was the father. Now, my self-worth was so low that I wasn't too sure about that, but that's the only deal I had going, so I said yes. And we got married. The amazing thing about it was I still didn't have a job, didn't have a driver's license, didn't have nothing going for me. And along with those kind of responsibilities come responsibilities. And I don't like responsibilities because they always interfere with my drinking. And she had this little girl. And they decided that I should do some things, and they didn't consult me about them, but they wanted me to go to work, and they wanted me to do a little, you know, they always want us to do something. Shape up and fly right. Be like the rest of the people. I never really wanted to be like anybody else. I don't know if I really drank so that I could feel a part of. I mean, I'm an egotist. What I had problems with was getting you in step. If I could get you all in step, then I could fit right in. Therefore, I was frustrated. But I drank essentially for the effect. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us why men and women drink. We drink for the effect. And after some period of drinking, we cannot distinguish between true and false, right or wrong. That's why I drank. Because I liked that feeling of nothingness. Psychiatrists call that a sociopath. And I liked that feeling. And they wanted me to do things like get a house with a little white picket fence around it. Get a dog and get a cat. Go to work. Do these things. And, you know, I'm the kind of a guy that can go over to your house to get the Easter bunny for my kid, and I get the one with ringworm. I do it. I got me a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated my ass, man. I took him to obedience class, and we both got 86 out of him. Said we was violent. Got this cat for the kid. One morning, full of guilt and remorse, they sent me down to the veterinarian to get this cat neutered, and I don't know what he did to her, but it sure made her mad. And every time I'd see her lay down, she'd attack me, and I didn't get her declawed either. And I'd come home, and I'd lay down, and I'd do the things that I'd like to do, which was rest, because I was tired, and the cat would attack me, and the dog would be running around barking, the kid would be bawling, and she'd just be yakety yak and yak, and I'd have to leave and go do what I did best, which is go out there and do my thing. After a period of time, it became necessary for me to leave Texas. That'll happen to you if you stay there and do the things I was doing. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they call those trips geographics. In Texas, they call it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And I loaded up this woman, this kid, and this dog, and this cat, and I headed for California. Now, most people can make the trip from where I was to where I was going in 3 days. It took me 30. And that's a story in itself. But I'll tell you, the bottom line is, the minute I rolled across the California state line, I got arrested because I took me with me. And wherever I went, I went. And they arrested me because I didn't have no mirror on the right-hand side of this car that was pulling all the stuff that we had piled in this trailer with this crazy dog running up and down inside this station wagon we was in. And I had this woman hanging. That was her job. That was her assignment. And them pre-Al-Anons, they stick in there. And she is hanging out that window over there looking to see if anybody's in that lane so I could get over. And they arrested us. Said, we don't have human rearview mirrors in California. In Oklahoma, it's all right. But I found a house that was just right for me, and I found a place where I could live. I had a drunken uncle I hooked up with, and he found me this house. No one had lived in it for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, and just perfect. Had a couple of 3 yards of gravel they dumped in the backyard when somebody had an idea to build a patio, and that's as far as it got, you know. I like that, you know what I mean? I understood that. I got a deal on it. I said, don't worry, I'll move the gravel. 3 or 4 years later, it was still there, you know. But the best deal was there was a bunch of dope fiends living next door. They were AWOL from Marine El Toro Base. They were laying out, taking LSD, laying in the front yard, watching the sun come up and go down. That interested me. I never seen nothing like that down there where I come from. The motorcycle gang lived right next door. They were my kind of people. They was over there getting into deep thought. You know, my kind of people, and I love that. You know, I mean, I fit right in, backed right in, unloaded and left, you know. And I'm not one of those that like to geographic my family a whole lot because it takes time for them to pack when they get all that stuff, responsibilities. And I'd go off and do what I did best. I worked in the oil fields. I left Texas, Oklahoma to get out of the oil fields, came to California and got in the oil fields because the guy bet me one time, bet me $50 I couldn't drink a quarter ten weight oil, and I did. And I thought, I think I'll get in the oil business. I mean, we think of things like that. We don't need a big resume. I mean, things just come to you. And I'd go off and work in Louisiana and Alaska, and then I'd have to come home. And, you know, it's a big job to come from New Orleans and get to LAX and then get from LAX out to Orange County where I lived and not go on to Vegas. You know, it was a big sacrifice for me to get home, and I get home, knock on the front door. There she'd be. It's like her mouth was attached to the doorknob, you know. The kid would be bawling, the dog would be biting me in the ass, and the cat would be scratching me, and I'm just trying to say, Daddy's home, for Christ's sake. I've come a long ways to come home. Yelling and screaming. Now, I like guns. Guns will enhance conversation. You can shoot a .44 mag off next to somebody's ear, and they'll pay attention to you. They won't hear nothing, but they'll pay attention to it. But that woman wasn't afraid of guns. She'd be talking, and I'd stick a gun right in her mouth. And she wouldn't shut up. She picked up carrying a 12-inch butcher knife around all the time. Was always attacking me when I laid down to sleep or passed out. I stuck a gun in her mouth one day, and she's yelling and screaming, and I just stuck it right in her mouth, and I said, I'm going to kill you. She stuck that butcher knife right in my stomach. She said, go first. Now, I said, you're crazy. She said, no. When you shoot me, it'll knock me back, and on the way back, I'll gut you. You know, samurai warriors train all their life to be able to get the last kill, and a pre-Al-Anon intuitively knows that. You know? I passed out one time, and she stabbed me in the back 100 and some times. I come to her, Jesus, something's wrong with my back. She says, let me look. She said, oh, you've been drinking, your back's broke out with all that acne. Let me put a little rubbing alcohol on it. Boy, I know vengeance. And I'd have to leave, and I'd go off, and then I'd come home, and there she'd be, you know, and I'd get everything calmed down, you know. Yeah, just calm down. She'd always want me to do the things that I promised I'd do and didn't do, you know. She always remembered things that I should have done that I didn't remember. She always knew more about where I'd been than I did, and I don't like talking to anybody know more about where I've been than I did, because she got the credit card receipts and all that stuff when they come home, and she'd say, you know you were here? No, I didn't know that. Well, you were. I got the receipt. And she'd talk to me about that kind of stuff, and I'd finally get her calmed down and be alone about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd promise her I was going to do all the things I was supposed to do, and I'd lay down, pass out. Wake right up!
God, I'd like to wake up quick. Jesus.
Speed freaks wake up quick. I wake up, run out of the kitchen, put about 100 mini bennies in the blender, a little orange juice, a couple of raw eggs, get her going, a little something to get your heart started, and get you a glass and fill it full of vodka and hit it a couple of times, a little Tabasco sauce so that you can call it a Bloody Mary. Chase that and do that. I always had an intuitive idea after I did that. Ought to do something. I think I'll mow my front yard. 4:30 in the morning, I like to mow my front yard. I didn't have a front yard, I had front dirt. I like to mow front dirt because when you mow front dirt, you don't need a grass catcher. My lawnmower didn't have no grass catcher, no muffler, and I'd get out there in the garage looking for my lawnmowers out there underneath all of that stuff. One morning I was out there and that thing went off 2 inches behind my belly button and I couldn't find the rope to my mower, and it don't make any difference when all that stuff goes off 2 inches behind your belly button because you can push start your lawnmower. Get her out in the front yard, get her going. One morning my mower died. I didn't have a good maintenance program either, and I figured it must have been something I brought from Texas, but don't run, kill it. I blowed a hole in my lawnmower with a .44 Magnum one morning. I was just about to bury it, and the cops come along. Wanted to talk to me about that. We got in a meaningful conversation, and they ran my head into their nightstick 5 or 6 times. And then she come out and she wanted to know what was going on. She stirred up all this stuff, and then the cops wanted to arrest her, and then I had to fight the cops because they were supposed to arrest her, and we finally got things calmed down. And they said, okay. By then I'd get a little depressed because what goes up must come down. And I had an old chair in my house that I'd go sit in and drink a little wine. An old recliner, lean just right, and you can lay in there and drink that wine. And her and the kid and the dog and the cat, they'd line up on their line of contempt. Look at you over there. I had an old Winchester 97 shotgun my grandpappy gave me, and I'd drag her out from under that chair, and I'd jack her back and stick the barrel in my mouth and click the trigger. It was empty, of course, because I didn't want to commit suicide until the crowd got there. One time I jacked that thing back, seen something red go by. I thought, I wonder what that was. And I pulled over and flicked that trigger, and that damn thing went off, blew the air conditioner clear out of the wall. That one put a shell in that gun, tried to kill me. Had a hell of a fight, and the air conditioner's flopping around, and the cops come, run my head into the nightstick 5 or 6 times. Then the dope fiend neighbors come over and call the cops pigs while they're beating on me. I said, don't call the cops pigs when they're beating on me, man. I don't do that to you. You know, that makes them mad. Then they send that funny van that's got the sports coat that ties in the back. I never could be cool in the straitjacket. And they take me down to the nut ward and tie me down on one of those tables. I was laying there yelling, screaming one time. And I thought, I wonder why I'm yelling, screaming. So I stopped yelling and screaming, and I listened. Everybody else was tied down to the tables yelling and screaming. I didn't want to be different. So I started screaming again. Then they said, if you'll quit screaming, we'll let you make one phone call. I went over to the phone and I called her up and I said, you got to get me out of this nut ward. You got me back in the nut ward. I'm not crazy. I've got to have some help here. And if you don't come and get me, I'm going to kill you. She'd hang up. I'd tear the phone off the wall in the nut ward. That's a no-no. That's good for 72 more hours of observation. Finally, they let me out and I go back home. Get it all started all over again. Now, that's kind of the way I was when I was a social drinker. And I say that with all honesty because, you see, I consider any of my drinking prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time as social drinking. And I was doing those things, and I found myself standing in front of a judge, and he's talking to me about going to the penitentiary for 3 to 5 years for something I didn't remember doing. But I'm sure he had the right guy. And through a series of events and some lawyer that was standing around there while they gave me an opportunity to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't want to go to the penitentiary. And so I went home and I told my wife, I said, I've got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a meeting around the corner over here and it starts at 8:30 and it's over 10. I said, good. I've talked to the lawyer and he says, that's what you need. So I laid down on the couch along about 8 o'clock. She came over there and stuck that butcher knife right in my face. She said, get up. I said, where are we going? She said, we're going to go to that A&A meeting. And I got up and I got in the car and she took me over to this church and had that AA sign out front. And I thought, oh, jeez, I've sunk to the bottom now, you know. She said, "What time's that meeting over?" I said, 10 o'clock. She said, "I'm going to tell you something, fat boy. If your ass comes out of that door before 10, I'm going to gut you." Now, I'll tell you something about that. You can keep a drunk like me sober if you got a crazy woman waiting in the parking lot out there. But you can't keep me long. And I found out something about going to Alcoholics Anonymous when you're not really, really an alcoholic. Because if you're not really, really an alcoholic, you're not really an alcoholic. And I heard things in there. They said things like, "We won't guarantee you've had your last drink, but we'll guarantee you'll never enjoy another one." That's what I heard. They talked about the steps and sponsorship and going to a lot of meetings. I didn't understand that. An amazing thing. The first step of Alcoholics Anonymous says that I am powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. Going to one meeting a week, I proved that that was not apply to me. Because I went to one meeting a week for 4 months. At the end of 4 months, I was sitting in my house and I was thinking about what was going on. And I knew I'd beat that deal down at the courthouse. That old judge let me off, had a nice parole officer. I was sitting there in that house, and that old dog's laying down there next to me. I pat him, he's smiling, and that cat's in my lap purring. The kid's over here, pat the kid on the head. She's in the kitchen fat and happy, and I'm back in the big bedroom. And I thought, hell, I've been too hard on myself. I've prematurely gone to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I'll be there someday, but I'll be old. And I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. An amazing thing happened. I got struck drunk almost immediately. Almost immediately. And I know some things today. I know some things about that. There's nothing cute or funny about that anymore. There's nothing cute or funny about that at all. That's living screaming hell. Because everything that ever meant anything to me went away. And the anger was tenfold. And the frustration and the bewilderment was tenfold. And you know what's going on because it don't work. And you know it won't work for you because you're different. You know all those things. And a lot of things happened to me in the next 4 years of my drinking and using. A lot of things happened to me. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that I am to tell what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I hear a lot of people say what it used to be like and what it's like today. Seems like there's some built-in thing in us that doesn't want to remember the what happened. That's not what that says. It says we're supposed to share our experience, our strength, and our hope. That what happened is my strength. You know, in the 12 and 12, the first step, the next last paragraph of the first step says that an alcoholic must hit a bottom before they are willing to do what's necessary to be done in the next 11 steps. Because what's necessary to be done in the next 11 steps is contradictory to anything the drinking drunk could ever think about doing, want to do, or even be forced to do, because it says you have to come to believe that some power can restore you to sanity. And I always said, you can't be restored to something you never had. Anymore, you can come back from someplace you've never been. And then it says you have to make some decision to turn your will and your life over to some God. Now, I come from the Bible Belt. Touché, Debbie. I come from the Bible Belt, and I've been baptized, sprinkled, dipped, flipped, tattooed, and screwed. And it didn't take. It did not take. So I knew making a decision didn't mean nothing. And it says you got to write all this stuff down on paper and sign and take and give it away to somebody. My lawyers have been telling me forever, don't ever put that on paper, and for God's sakes, don't tell anybody. And it says, go look at your character defects. All my character defects had character. What would you be if they didn't? And then make a list of people you'd harmed, who'd harmed you. If you had anything to do with me, you had to be a little bit wrong. Why do I got to do it? And then look at yourself every day. Man, I did thousands of dollars worth of alcohol and dope just to keep from looking at me every day. And then pray and meditate. I didn't know nothing about prayer. And meditation, when I flipped into meditation, I always went into a sexual fantasy. You know? And then give it away. The 12th step, you got to give it away. It says you got to give it away. And I don't know any drinking drunk that wants to give nothing away. So you see, you got to hit a bottom. And I don't know what your bottom is, but I'll never ever pray to God, forget mine. The last 3.5, 4 years of my drinking, a lot of things happened to me. But I can share some with you because it was told to me that I must, that I might not ever forget where I come from, that I'm never, ever going to be able to go out there and sit on that bar stool and have
drink or two and tell them funny jokes and get drunk and fall off the bar stool. I remember many, many times, but I remember one in particular when I was standing in my kitchen. 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm looking down the hallway, and a little 9-year-old girl standing down at the end of that hallway looking at me. And she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her. She didn't run down there and grab me by the leg and say, "Daddy, will you play with me today?" She didn't even say, "Daddy, please don't beat me and Mommy." She looked at me, and I looked at her, and I took a drink out of that jug, and without a sound, she'd be gone. Because the only thing she was looking at me for was to see where I was going so she could go the other way. Or maybe one morning, I don't know what time it was, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm standing in my bathroom. And I cooked up some of that stuff in that spoon, got it in that syringe, and I turned around and stick it in my arm, and I looked at me in the mirror in that bathroom. And when I looked at me in that mirror in that bathroom, I noticed a little 9.5-year-old girl looking through the crack of the door. My eyes caught hers. And I knew it was just what I thought it was. And she didn't say, "Daddy, will you come play with me today?" She didn't say, "Daddy, please don't beat me and Mommy today." She looked at me and I looked at her, and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that she knew. And I knew there was no way I could stop this deal. And I turned around and I did what I had to do. Without a sound, she was gone. You see, there is some gray zone beyond hate. There is some place that this disease and the ugliness of it will take you. Where we can live with no feelings, with no hope. I'm a violent drunk. Anger's been my cross to bear. Because I know fear. Fear's been my partner all my life. I'd a lot rather my cross to bear be lust, but it happens to be anger. In the last years of my drinking, I was arrested many, many times. And it was forced to me to look at this. Many of those arrests were due to me beating my wife and my daughter physically so bad that they could not get out of the house or they were hospitalized. Now, I won't debate with anybody about whether physical violence is worse than verbal abuse. But I want you to know one thing. When I was beating the hell out of you, I was talking to you, too. And I was telling you, you're nothing. And you're never going to be nothing. And that's the way it is. And that's the way I live, not one day, not one week, not one month, but years. And we stand out there and we say we hurt no one but ourselves. I stole souls. And it's the way it was. My last drunk lasted 100 days. I locked myself up in a motel room. And I stayed in there. With me. Now, the book says that we seek lower companionship and we get down to the point where we're drinking with ourselves. That's about as low as you can go. And I stayed in there because the heat was on and I had a couple of deals I'd turned and I had hidden out. You know, I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous wondering about my old drinking partners because I ran out of them. There's two different groups of people that had a hit on me. One guy was a business deal and I'd burn him on a deal. I said I'd do something, didn't. He lost everything he had. He put the word out he's going to kill me, have me killed. I was muling drugs. And I was supposed to deliver a package, and I didn't. I put it away for me. A little ace in the hole, what the hell? And I head out, and when I come out of that motel room, I couldn't stand me anymore. And I prayed to God somebody blow a hole in me. And I came out of that motel room, and, you know, the seed had been planted. And I came back home, and the wife and the kid... Whenever he left. And I drank, and it didn't work. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, it ain't going to work. You don't take it away. The madness is in there, and I know exactly what's going on, and it don't work anymore. And I'd reach back in there, and I'd try to get that little moment when it worked, or maybe that 30 minutes, and it wouldn't go away. And the madness inside of me drove me insane. And I was crawling around on that floor in there, lip-dragging drunk, slobbering on myself. I've been a lot of places and done a lot of things. I'd made a lot of money. I'd spent a lot of money. But giving them my best shot, that's where I ended up. That's what happened. And for the first time in my entire life, some people believed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they believed in prayer, and prayer does work. It's just a matter of time. Works in God's time. through a series of events, a little gray-headed man came to my house. He did a 12-step call on me, and he told me something. He said, you'll never have to drink again as long as you live if you don't want to. And I could not even conceive how you could do that. I had no idea how you could do it. I believe he could do it. And then he said the magic word. He said, I'm going to tell you something else. You don't ever have to be lonely again as long as you live if you don't want to. God, I didn't want to live in that loneliness, that damnable loneliness, that pit of emptiness inside of me that had been there so long. For some reason, I believed him, and I followed him like a puppy dog. He had to take a gun away from me first, but he was willing to do that. And I followed him like a puppy dog, and he took me down, put me in a detox. And he gave me one of them green, funny-looking smock things with no back end, took my clothes off, and set me down on one of them slick leatherette couches, and had a bunch of weird people running around there, the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, talking a bunch of weird things and asking a bunch of weird questions. And all I knew how to do was radiate hate. And I'd sit there and radiate hate. But I felt safe. And I stayed in there for a period of time, and they found out things about me. It's an amazing thing about the old-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous. They have questions that they ask. How long did you drink? So about 22 years. I said, well, a guy like you will have to go to a meeting every day for at least 22 years before you can have a night off and go to a movie. Said, you'll have to work the steps. And you'll have to get a sponsor. And a hard-hearted sponsor. They told me that. Said, you'll have to get one of them sponsors that's more concerned for your life than whether you like him or not. And they told me, said, there's only one guy around here we know that might be able to help you, and his name's Rotten Ron. Hell of a guy. I mean, I understood that. And after a period of time, they gave me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, kicking her butt, and sent me home. I went home, knocked on the front door, and there she was, right at the front door. And I said, I've got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every damn day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do, bitch? I mean, just because you sober up don't mean you're all wonderful. You know, she looked me right in the eye, and she says, oh, I've been going to Al-Anon. The kid's been going to Al-Ateen. The dog's been going to Al-Dog. The cat's been going to Al-Cat. What are you going to do, you know? I didn't know what to do, so I went and called my sponsor. And I started going to meetings. You know, there's some pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization after you sober up. They want you to go to work. They want you to pay all this money back. I owed a lot of money, and it was all due. And some of it was due to some people you got to pay back immediately. I hear some of these people stand up here and say, well, I wrote him a letter, and I said, I'll pay you a dollar. I knew better than do that. And I had that package over there in that safety deposit box that I knew had to be straightened out. You know, I'm grateful, you know, because I've learned things in Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety that today is my greatest strength. And I'm grateful for the old-timers. I'm grateful for the foundation they gave me. But there's certain things you have to do. You don't snivel about it. You do it. And I had to call these people up and say, I got this package over there. And I got to give it back. And I drove up to Oxnard and I met them in a parking lot and I walked over there and gave them that package and told them I got to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't know what else I'm going to do, but that's what I'm going to do today, stay sober. And they said, get the hell out of our life and don't call us. We'll call you. And I turned around and I walked back to my car. I just handed those people over $300,000 worth of narcotics. And I walked back to my car, and I didn't feel or hear that noise, that click. And I knew they were going to blow a hole in me the size of a watermelon. And I made that long walk back over to my car, and I got in and I started home. And I know today what that was. I know that was one of my great reference points that has been since repeated many times because I learned something. Every good thing in my life is preceded by a wall of fear. You got to go through the fear or you don't get the good. That's what I was afraid of. When I get in that wall of fear, I had to get out. And I drank. And that day was one great reference point. and I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to work. Not at work. And I had to go down to Texas and meet with a guy and try to borrow some money to pay these people back. I owed $265,000. And I went down to see this little banker down in Texas, and I knew him. I'd gone to school with him, gone to high school with him. I was a couple of grades ahead of him, and one Saturday afternoon down around the park, he was a little rich kid in town, you know, his daddy was a banker, and down there around Saturday afternoon at the park, I jerked his pants down in front of the girl. Everybody laughed, thought it was funny. Well, Grandpappy made me go apologize to his daddy about that. Well, here I am years later, man, and he's the only guy I know that'll loan me this money. And I went down to see him, went in, and I told him my story. I said, I'm sober, I owe this money, and you know what it's for, and you know who it's to. Here's what I got, and I don't know, I give him my best shot. You know, resentments are good for some people if you ain't an alcoholic, I guess, because he hated me enough that he said, I'm going to loan you this money. And he said, I'm going to loan it to you at 20% interest, and I'm going to tell you something else. If you miss one payment, I'm going to kill you. Now, that will be a pretty good incentive to do something. And I started doing something. I wrote these checks, paid these people off, and it took some period of time. And I knew, you know, I'd talk to people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd say, how about this financial amends? Well, you got to make it. I said, I'm willing to make it, but don't tell me how to get the money. Okay. Do whatever you got to do. Don't drink. Go to meeting. You know, there's an amazing thing. When we ask people to stand up when they're new, it's an amazing thing. I love it. Because the alcoholic ego is unbelievable. If you read the book, AA Comes of Age, on page 245, it talks about the alcoholic ego. It's an amazing thing. It will revive itself. Franklin talked about it last night. You get a guy, you hold him up one or 30 days, stand there. We ask you to stand up so that we can see that you know that we know that you don't know. And you're kind of insignificant. But there's an amazing thing down where I go to meetings. When you get 31 days, all of a sudden you're significant. And you know it all. God, the next thing they want you to clean up, shape up. Man, as soon as I started getting things going for me, I'd go down and hang around a Lana Club down there. I went down and bought myself a set of threads, man. Dressed up. I was so crazy that my sponsor made me stand on one side of the room and they'd point at me. Look at him. It's over 3 years without a change of attitude. You know? I had so many guns on me that if you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been a mushroom cloud. Just crazy. I don't know about people come to Alcoholics Anonymous, put the plug in the jug, everything's wonderful, pink cloud. You know. I'm nuts, you take that away from me. I'm crazy. I'm running around crazy. And I'm riding to meetings all the time with this weird sponsor. And I ask him, I said, talk to me about God. And he said stupid things like, see that guy over there? And I said, yeah. He said, I don't want to kill him. I said, well, I don't even know him. He said, good. Do you want to kill him? And I said, no. He said, that's spiritual. Oh, okay. Had a meeting I went to. I believe in home meetings. They told me to get a home meeting. I got a home meeting on Friday night. I go down there. Bunch of crazy people in there talking my native tongue, profanity. And they'd talk sick stuff in there, man. I knew it was sick. And I'd sit in there and I'd think, I'm going to kill that sucker right after the meeting. I ought to put him out of his misery. Somebody else would talk, I'd say the same thing. Sometimes I'd get my gun out and show them. After the meeting be over, they'd all stand up and put their arms around and say, keep coming back, sicko, we love you. And I'd think, yeah, I'll just come back next week and throw a grenade in here and kill them all. I go to a meeting. Amazing thing. I wanted to be an attraction. They was talking to me about being an attraction all the time. You know, you got a program of attractions. So I went down and bought myself a big Lincoln. I mean, that's attraction. Parked it out in front of the Alano Club so the newcomers would have hope. I was standing in there in that Alano Club one day, just crazier than hell, you know, trying to work the steps and working. And I go home, and that lady was going all them out on me. I see things happen to her, and the kid was okay, you know, but I'm just nuts. And I'm standing in there, and all of a sudden there's a weirdo standing next to me. Weirdest looking guy you ever saw. mean, he wasn't tall enough to be a man. He wasn't short enough to be a midget. Just weird. He had hair sticking out everywhere. Had a welder's hat turned over to one side. Had strawberries and cherries on it. And he was a weird guy, you know. Had a pair of pants hit him about his knees and thongs on. And I'd seen him in a meeting the night before. He was the treasurer of the meeting. He stole all the money and said, I ain't paying it back. And he's standing next to me and he says, will you be my sponsor? Oh, Jesus. So I don't know. I'll have to ask my sponsor. And my sponsor is standing over on the other side of the room. And I went over and I said, see that weirdo over there? And he said, yeah. I said, he asked me to be his sponsor. He says, I know. I sent him over there. Said, you go over there and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do exactly what he says. Now, you know, that didn't make sense to me. I wasn't no dummy. I was 3.5 years sober. I was dying inside. But I was 3.5 years sober, and I knew when my sponsor said, you go tell him you'll be his sponsor, but you do what he says. That didn't make sense to me. But then it never did make sense to me, and I didn't argue with my sponsor, so I did it. I was thinking all the way, you know, at least the doctors or lawyers ought to come to me, for Christ's sake, not some weirdo. And I went over there and told that guy, I said, my sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do? So I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln. He wasn't stupid. Me and that weirdo started going for rides in the Lincoln, man. I said, you go out this door, and I'll go out this door, and I'll meet you out front. And he says, no, I want to go with you. And he grabbed a hold of me, and away we go, you know. I was sober 3.5 years. I had 2 friends, and neither one of them was my sponsor. And I walked by the door, and they looked at me and said, boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. I'd get him that Lincoln, and he'd talk sick, sick stuff to me. Sick stuff. And then he'd say that stupid thing. He'd say, did you ever do anything like that? And I'd say, yeah, I did, matter of fact. And I'd start telling him all my sick stuff, and pretty soon he'd say, you're sick, man. We need a meeting. And we'd go, I'd take him home, and he'd go in. I'd say, I'll be back to get you. Now, you just wait right here. Don't worry about it. I'll come back to get you. And I'd go back to get him, and there he'd be. His hair sticking everywhere, just like he stood in there. He always looked the same. I'd say, why don't you comb your hair? And he said, I did. Get in that car, going down the road, and he's talking sick shit, man. I mean, sick. And I'd say, man, you're sick. You ought to work the steps. And he said, okay. Let's go to a meeting. We'd go to a meeting, walk in, and they'd look at us and say, man, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. Amazing things happened to me. You know, I didn't realize it, and I'd moved out of the old neighborhood, got me a nice house, one of them houses where, you know, you don't want everybody in the neighborhood to know you're an A&A, and you tell everybody, you know, if you got stickers on your car, park them down there, okay? No newcomer cars in the driveway, because they always leak oil. And I was over there one morning reading a spiritual book. They come and knock at my front door, and I went to the front door, and there he was. Standing in my front door. His old car was in the driveway. Had stickers all over it. AA and Jesus loves AA, and AA loves Jesus, and God is coming, and boy, is he pissed, and all that stuff. And it drained 6 quarts of oil on my driveway. And he's standing there all weirded out, had a big book with paper stuck in it, and I said, what do you want? Looked like half of him is stuck in the concrete, and the other half of him is going to Tijuana. And he says, I want to work the steps like you did. And I'm thinking, I'm sure I've worked them. And I said, get in here quick before my neighbors see you, you know? He got in there, and I said, the first step says that I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life's unmanageable. I'm powerless, I'll let you in, and my life's unmanageable because it looks like you're going to stay. The second step says that, you know, we're going to believe that something can restore us to sanity. I know you're nuts, and I'm talking to you, and we've been going down the road together, so I know pretty sure we're both nuts. So we must be on step 3. It's okay. So we went in the kitchen, and I said, I had to get on my knees, another human being, and do that third step prayer. And he got on his knees right there in my kitchen. He said, get down here. And I'm thinking, I think I'm supposed to tell him what to do. But I got on my knees, I got down there, and I got the big book, opened it up, that third step prayer, and we read that third step prayer, and he cuddled up underneath my arm, you know, felt kind of good. Finished that prayer, and I thought, if my wife sees me on my knees, this weirdo, she's going to know I whacked out for sure. The cat walked by and looked at us weird, you know. He jumped up and says, now I want to do my fourth step. And I said, I got you now, sucker. You're supposed to have that done before you come to your sponsor's house. And He pulled a bunch of paper out of that big book, threw it across the table, and he said, I can't write. And he said, here's some paper and a pencil. I'll talk, you write. He started talking. Hell, I started writing, you know. I'm writing away. Hour and a half went by, and he said, did you ever do anything like that? And I said, yeah, I did some stuff like that. And I started telling him all my stuff. Pretty soon, a couple of things come up. I forgot to tell my sponsor in my fifth step, and I knew God was in the room, and this dingling couldn't read, so I just put some of my shit in his. What the hell? We burn it. I feel good, and so does he. He's still sober, and so am I. Pretty soon, he ran around there and kissed me on the cheek and said, I love you. And I thought, oh, man, well, it's all over now. Divorce her and go with him. Yeah. I'd seen him hugging around here. He ran out in the front yard and said, I love you real big Sunday afternoon right in front of God and everybody. And I said, well, the neighbors all know now, you know. But I knew something. For the first time in my entire life, I'd got out of myself. I'd sat around Alcoholics Anonymous for 3.5 years, dying inside. Dying inside, because I knew it worked for you. I could sit in the back of the meetings, and there was something inside of me that said, maybe it's that thing that says we're different. I don't know. I knew I had no other place to go, man. When I got here, I got no running room. They told me, don't drink, don't use, and don't run. And I knew what they meant. I got no running room. This is it. But I could sit in the back of that room and die. And at 3.5 years sober, I ended up in an intensive care unit, bleeding, hemorrhaging. And the doctor says, we don't know why. We don't know what's wrong with you. You're one of those 1% that dies. And I knew what he was talking about. Because I couldn't forgive myself. See, I know I'm a liar and a cheat, thief. I'm a murderer. I'm a rapist. I'm a child molester. I'm all those things. It's like I had it tattooed on my forehead. You ain't nothing and you're never going to be nothing. Yet that day when that ding-a-ling come to my house, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt why it was I did that fifth step. You see, you got to do a fifth step before you qualify to receive a fifth step. And you don't get the deal until it makes full circle. It's got to make full circle or you don't get the deal. Because it is in forgiving that we are forgiven. And I didn't know that. I'm grateful for my sponsor and the old-timers. Because they could see me dying. And they knew what to do. They knew what to do. And I just followed direction. And I could see things a little better. And I saw something happening in that home. I saw that lady. And that day when that ding-a-ling sat in my house and he shared with me, he had two daughters. And he talked to me about his daughters and how he loved his daughters. And I sat there at that kitchen table that day and we shared our deepest, darkest secrets. And somebody knew other than my sponsor. And I let him leave. I don't let you know that about me and then let you leave. You can hurt me. And I didn't understand those feelings, but I knew something that day when he sat there in my kitchen and we talked about our daughters. He told me how his daughter had come home one day from school and he'd been sober a little while and his daughter came home and she had a little flower she'd cut out at school. She crawled up in his lap and she gave him this flower and she put her arm around him. And she said, Daddy, I want to give you a flower that'll never die. And I sit there that day and I talked to him about my own daughter. I talked to him how I'd been sober, I don't know, a year and a half. And my daughter came up to me and she said, Daddy, what are you doing next Saturday? And I said, I don't know. She said, would you come down to this place a certain time? Because I was sober, I could say yes, and because I was sober, I could show up. And I showed up that day at 10 o'clock that morning, and I walked in a room about this size, and I leaned up against the wall in the back of that room. And I looked up there, and unbeknownst to me, my daughter had gone and taken a little modeling course, and she was graduating that day. And she'd been going to Alateen all the time, and I didn't know. All I was doing was just staying sober. And I leaned up against that wall and I watched a bunch of little girls come out on this stage and they're modeling a beautiful dress. And I saw my little girl standing on that stage up there and there was a sparkle in her eye. And there was a look about her I'd never ever seen. And I wanted to scream at those people. If you only knew where that kid come from, if you knew what it was like and what it's like today for her to stand up there with that dress on,
some inside of me wanted to scream to the loud of my voice, and I knew I couldn't.
Because, you see, I couldn't take credit for that.
All I've been doing is going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I got to lean up against that wall that day and let the daddy tears come down. And they weren't tears of sorrow, they were tears of joy. And I leaned against that wall that day. And that's what I got to share with that ding-a-ling. That I am so grateful that I was sober, that I didn't have to do the things that would have happened in that home to that little girl when she made the transition from a little girl to a woman had I been drinking. Those were the intimate gratitudes that we knew that day sitting there. Not the trash. Gratitude.
I'd like to tell you every day's been a holiday and every meal's been a banquet from then on.
You know, I heard a story.
When I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to share it with you. It's a story about a little farm boy. He lived on a farm, and he was standing out there one day with his daddy, and a man came by. He was a circus man, and this farm they lived on, the barn, was right next to the road, and the man wanted to put a poster up on the side of this barn, a poster of a circus that was coming to town. And the circus man probably gave the farmer a few bucks, and they put this poster up on the side of the barn. The little boy stood there and watched him put the poster up on the side of the barn. He'd never seen anything like that in his entire life. He'd lived on a farm all his life, and he'd never seen animals like that. And he'd never seen people dressed like that that was in that beautiful colored poster. And he was completely in awe. And he asked his daddy, he said, "Daddy, when the circus comes to town, can I go see it?" And being a good father, the father said, "Yes, son, if you work real hard come time for the circus to come to town, I'll let you go." And the little boy worked real hard, and come time for the circus to come to town, why? Father gave the son 50 cents. The little boy walked 5 miles to town. When he got to the edge of town, there it was. The circus had come in on the train. And like always in those little towns, why, the circus had set up a big top, big tent down on the other end of town, and they'd come in on the train and they'd make the parade down through the center of town. And they were making that parade that day, and the little boy sat down on the curb, and he'd never seen anything like that in his entire life. There they were, all the beautiful people and all the beautiful animals, and he was totally amazed. And he sat there on the curb, and as the parade went by, the last person in the parade was a clown. When the clown went by the little boy flipped his 50-cent piece up into the clown's hat, and he got up and he walked 5 miles back home. And when he got home, his daddy said, "Son, did you see the circus?" And the little boy said, "Yeah, Daddy, I saw the circus." That's a sad story. It's not a happy story. He didn't see the circus. He just saw the passing parade. This is a passing parade. I don't want to be a sad story. Man, I've been a sad story all my life. I want to get in that big top. I want in there where it's happening. I want to be inside where the whole deal's going on. That big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the big top. And if I come in here and I embrace this thing with all my being, I just switched obsession. I switched the obsession from drinking and using to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what an unbelievable obsession. And they told me in the very beginning, you're going to have some good days. And you take those good days and you file them away because you're going to need them. And I'm going to tell you, I've had me some bad days. Bad days. I had 11 years of good feelings. But I have had me some bad days. And if you let people around here tell you you don't have some bad days, don't ask them for a ride home. And they told me that would come. 9.5 years sober. I'm standing in front of a federal judge, and he's talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy. You heard Franklin talk about it last night. 9.5 years sober, he's found himself looking at those steps. 9.5 years sober. I'm standing in front of a federal judge. And he's talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy. And I'm standing there, and you know what I'm thinking 9.5 years sober? I'm thinking, I've been the chairman of the Southern California Convention. I've been a big deal. I can take you to a meeting where there's at least 50 people that call me sponsor. And there'll be at least half of those people tell you that I saved their life. And I can take you over here to a house, and I can show you a beautiful lady and a little girl. To live a beautiful and very comfortable life. And I can take you to a dude down in Texas, and he'll tell you how I paid all that money back in 8.5 years. See, but there were no words coming out of my mouth. stand in front of that judge that day.
You see, it's one thing to tell a lie, but it's another thing to live a lie. You can't live a lie and stay sober.
It didn't make any difference where I'd been or what I'd done. I'd done it for my sobriety.
But the alcoholic ego will revive itself. In that book, AA Comes of Age, it says, must be smashed in order to have longevity here. That means repeatedly, over and over again. You know, everything in my life failed me. Everything in my life failed me before I'd ask you for help. At 9.5 years sober, everything in my life failed me, including you. And that's exactly what it says in the ABC. It says there will come a time when there is no human power, but only your maintenance on a daily basis of prayer, meditation, giving this thing away the best you can, will have you in a position where you will know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there is some power greater than you taking care of you. And that day standing in front of that judge, I knew some things. I was scared to death. And he was talking to me about over 20 years of involvement with organized crime, a way of life. And they let me walk out of there that day, and they talked to me. And my lawyers told me, you go home, you get your house in order. Because there's at least a 50-50 chance you'll do a minimum of 5 years in the federal penitentiary. I destroyed trust because I'd been living a lie. I lost a good job. I watched that lady sit in that house and revert right back to the insane way of thinking and the anger and the fear. And I watched that little girl revert right back to those feelings. We're never immune to that. It's there all the time. The most elusive thing around here is time on this program. And I sit there in that house and the guilt came back over me. And I'm grateful for the old timers. I'm grateful for the old timers. They taught me many, many things. Some of them walked away from me. And they taught me something too. Some of them said, you're getting what you deserve. And they were unwilling to share with me. And they taught me something. But there were some who were willing to share. There were some old timers who were willing to come to me, and they felt that 9.5 years of sobriety was just as important as 9.5 days when it comes to trying to save an alky's life. And they literally held my hand. And they walked me through those days. And they told me things like, you never close the back doors. You got to close the back door. It's time. God don't give you more than you can handle. And it's time. That you got to change. That you got to make amends. See, I didn't know how to make amends. I knew how to make amends by saying I'm sorry or how much you want me to write the check for or those kind of deals. But to stand in front of somebody and say I'm wrong. God, I don't like to say I'm wrong. Because I got to change and I'm afraid of change. But they held my hand. And they walked me through that. What I know today I have as a result of that experience is strength. I got spiritual muscles today. And they don't come in a roll of dough, a big car, or a house on the hill. It comes in a feeling 2 inches behind your belly button that you got through those times and you didn't have to drink. I'm glad when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, some guy walked up to me and punched me right in the chest. And he said, I hear you're a bad dude, Ace. Yeah. He said, well, if you think you're tough, let's see you stay sober. And he wasn't kidding. Because it'll take everything you got and then some. The then some comes from places like this and people like you. I'm grateful to tell you that I got to close those back doors and I got to make the amends. And I got to stay sober. I didn't win. I didn't beat the deal. Don't ever think you beat the deal. It makes full circle on you. But what I got to know is a new relationship with a power greater than me. I got no memorandum. I got no loving pat on the shoulder from any God, but I had something there that was a strength that allowed me to walk through those times and know a new meaning. I'm grateful for my wife's program because she went to Al-Anon on a regular basis and got into it. And she reached for the old-timers. And I'm the kind of alcoholic that when everything's dying around me, I'll always reach for somebody's back to step on. I'll get some sick woman to step on her back so I can raise up, and I was about to do that. And I knew that'd get me drunk. And I'm grateful for the program of Al-Anon and the old-timers and that, because my wife went to the old-timers and they told her, you married that man and he's your husband. You married him because you love him. You go home and you don't let that man die in the bedroom. You don't let that man die in the bedroom, because if he dies in the bedroom, he's drunk. And I'm grateful for her strength to do that, because that brought us closer together. I built a bond. And we've been together over 25 years. She's my wife. She's my lover. And she's my very best friend. She's not my sponsor, and I'm grateful for that. But she's a lady in my life, and I'm going to finish my tower with her. And that little girl, she's a beautiful little girl, and I love her very much. Today, she's a professional model. Today, this very minute, she's in Milan, Italy. She's self-supporting through her own contributions, too. But she's been able to look beyond where other people feared to go because of this program and these steps. She don't even look like what she used to be. You know, my sponsor told me, you know, someday you'll stand there and the people will look at you and they will be impossible to imagine that you were what you used to be. That's the change. That's the spiritual experience. To know that that little girl is just my little girl, and I don't give a damn if she's 24 years old. She's still my little girl. And I know the damage, and I know the pain, and I know the heartache. But I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, my house is in order with her, and hers with me. It takes time. It takes time. It took 11 years on this program, and her going to Alateen and Al-Anon for her and I to sit together last Christmas and know beyond a shadow of a doubt, it's okay that she's a whole woman and I'm just her old man. You know, I had it all wrong. All my life I wanted to be the meanest man on the face of the earth. I really did. I had all the toys, I had all the costumes, I had all the deals to be the meanest man on the face of the earth, and I didn't know how to do that. I came here and you showed me that. If you want to know what the meanest man on the face of the earth looks like, you're looking at him. I'm him. It's that guy who lives down the street. He's got a wife and a kid and a dog and a cat. He can get up in the morning, he can go in and take a shower and put a clean set of threads on. He can walk in the kitchen, he can put his arms around his wife and say, baby, I love you. You mean something to me. He can walk across the room, and you don't have to kick the dog or the cat. And he can go in the other room and put his arm around his daughter and say, baby, I love you. Have a good day. And he can walk out and get in that car, go down the street, and he don't have to flip the crosswalk lady off. And he can go to work with them crap heads all day long, and he can get that check and take it home and put it in the bank, and he can pay them bills. And he can take a nap. And he can get up and he can go to a place like this, and he can laugh and cry and kiss them goodbye. And he can go home at night and put his head on that pillow and know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's some power greater than him taking care of him. See, it takes guts to do that. It takes guts to do that. Takes a strength beyond anything I've ever known. And I found it here. You know, I know some things because of my own experiences. And I know a relationship with a power greater than me. And I know that I have a relationship with people. That I can stand here and I can look you in the eye. And I know that's love, because love for me is an action. And for me to stand here and let you look in me gives me the freedom to look out into your eyes. And I didn't know what freedom was. I was just loose. Today I know what freedom is. Freedom's having the strength to do what's necessary to be done when called upon by your fellow man or your God, and not necessarily in that order. You see, I had it all wrong. I thought freedom and strength was attached to something that if I had you laying face down on that floor in a 38 at the back of your head and I'm taking your billfold, I thought I had you. But I don't. You got me. I know of one way and one way only for me to share with you the way I understand my God. I'll share it with you and then I'll shut up. There was a little cobbler man, good man. He died and he went to heaven. He was standing in front of God. And God said, cobbler man, you're a beautiful man. All your life you worked very hard and you took everything that you had and you gave it to your family and you were a good member of your community and you did all the things you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do them. The only problem was that you never really believed in God. 100%. And the cobbler told God, you know, if I could have just seen you one time, I would have believed. Or maybe if I could have heard your voice. Or maybe if I could have just touched you one time, I would have believed. And God said, well, you remember one day, it was a cold day, winter day, and there was snow on the ground, and you were in your shop working on the shoes, and you looked out the window, and a little girl was coming down the street, and she was cold. And you went to the door, and you invited her into your shop, and you set her down on a bench there, and you put your coat around her, and you let her warm up, and you noticed there was holes in her shoes, and you took her shoes off, and you patched the holes in her shoes, and you put them back on. She sat there without a sound. And you went back to work because you had to work, and pretty soon you heard a little rustling noise, and you looked up, and just as you turned around, the little girl was walking out the door of your shop. And just as she got to the center of that door, just about to walk out, she stopped and she turned and she smiled at you. And the cobbler told God, see, I remember that. I remember that day. God said, well, you remember one day you were working in your shop and an old bum came down the street and he walked in and he wanted to borrow some money to get something to eat and you didn't have any money, took all your money and you offered him one of your sandwiches. You had a couple of sandwiches in a sack there and you sit down with him, and you ate a sandwich, and he ate a sandwich, and there wasn't even a sound uttered. Pretty soon it's time for you to go to work. You got up, you went back, and started working on your shoes, and pretty soon you looked up, and the bum was getting ready to walk out of your shop. And just as he got at the door, he stopped, and he turned, and he reached across the counter, and he shook your hand. And the cobbler told God, yeah, I remember that day. God said, well, you remember one day you were working in your shop and a little old lady was going down the street and she was lost and she was confused and you brought her in your shop and you set her down. You calmed her down and found out her son was up the street and you went up and got him, brought him down and he got calmed down and you were working away and pretty soon it's time for her to go and just she was about to leave your shop. She turned and she looked at you and you looked at her and she said, bless you, my son. And the cobbler told God, yeah, I remember that. God said, well, little girl's smile was my smile. And that bum's handshake was my touch. And that little old lady's, bless you, my son, was my voice. I was there all the time. You just couldn't see and you couldn't hear and you couldn't feel. Now, on any given day, in a given moment, if I want to look back over my life, if I want to remember times when I stood in the back of a room and looked up front and I saw a little girl standing up there with that smile, baby, if I want to believe that's my God smiling at me, I can. I can. And on any given day, if I want to remember a time when my father, most bitter enemy, and me him, if I want to remember a time when we stood and he put his arms around me like a father should hold a son and he held me and I felt like a son, I felt like a small child in his arms. If I want to believe that's my God's touch, I can. And on any given moment, any given time when I'm reaching for something, if I want to remember those times when I wake up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in that house that I live in today, and that lady in bed with me, and there's no screaming, there's no yelling, there's no flesh tearing flesh. There's a quietness. And I listen to her breathe. And I reflect back on that time when she rolls back over and puts her arm around me. She whispers in my ear, I love you, baby. If I want to believe that's my God talking to me, I can. Now, you can say that's not right, but you can't say I'm wrong because I'm sober and I feel good about me. I know of no other way for me to tell you that I know my God is looking out for me. And if he's looking out for me, he's looking out for you. I'm very, very grateful. I'm very blessed that I'd be able to stand here today and know beyond a shadow of a doubt I'm right where I'm supposed to be. I'm with the people that I'm supposed to be with. And I'm right on time. I'm not 1 second too soon, not 1 second too late. I'm right where I'm supposed to be. That's a good feeling. Yeah, I know that my wants and my needs are exactly the same. Thanks to you. God bless, and I love you.